The collection of personal information has long been part of American culture. However, recent improvements in computing and the coming of the internet have led to a vast, vast increase in the number of people who are looking into our lives. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Washington Post reporter Robert O'Hara about his book, No Place to Hide. He says more than ever, the details about how we live are no longer our own. They belong to the companies that collect them and also to government agencies that buy or demand them in the name of keeping us safe. The book has been out now for a few months. Robert O'Hara has written a lot on these issues for the paper. He's a reporter at the Washington Post, associate of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for articles on privacy and technology, also a recipient of the 2003 Carnegie Mellon Cybersecurity Reporting Award, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The book, by the way, published by the Free Press. There is a website for the book, which is noplacetohide.net, if you're interested in more information. You either can go there directly or you can go through our website. We've set up a link there. As I said, questions are certainly welcome here on the program. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it's a long-distance call for you, we'll pay for the call. And if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, you can use that number. Actually, anybody who might happen to be listening on the internet can also use it as long as you're in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. O'Hara, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's really flattering to be on.
We certainly appreciate it. I guess the point to start with is perhaps to talk a little bit about how long and in what sort of detail pre-September 11th there were many people who were collecting data. And mostly, I guess, at that time, this was of a purely commercial nature. It was people who were interested in our buying habits, and it was mostly about marketing.
The data collection, it almost seems commonsensical, but a lot of people don't think that data collection has been going on for, many, many, many years. In the early part of the century, they would have special promotions. You could get your decoder ring if you wrote in. In some cases, they used that information to market to you. In the early part of the century, lots of information was collected about progressive political activists to crush union activism. And during World War I, subversives' names were kept in files so that the government could keep track of them. And the same thing happened in the 50s and in the 60s. The government became very, very good at collecting information through brute force, which is to say, old shoe leather or informants, and keeping files on political activists at the same time that marketers were collecting information to serve us better, to target market us. What changed is the power of computing that we all have lived through. People might recall those PCs they got in the late 80s, early 90s with the orange screens and how exciting it was, but in retrospect, how clunky they were. Now, of course, there's more computing power in a Walkman or in an iMac than there was in an entire building, back in the late 80s. As the computing power has grown, they've been able to collect almost unimaginable amounts of information. And the same goal was true in the 90s as it was back in the 60s and the 50s and before that, which is they wanted to get to know us better and target market us better.
And I guess it seems to me that one of the big points that you are making and perhaps the way in which this is a little bit new is the extent to which government is making use of information collected by private sources. Again, the kinds of things that you suggest, all those people who are watching what we're buying, who would like us to buy more of that or like us to buy other things, and perhaps also connected to that, the number of people that are collecting financial information on us, either to assess our creditworthiness or, again, trying to sell us services.
I appreciate your dispassion on this, because I've tried very, very hard to lay the facts out in a way that's lively and interesting but not shrill. But I should correct you on one thing, which is that this isn't a little bit new. The themes are similar. What's actually happening now is a revolution in our society that very few people understand, and it's a revolution because the aims are the same, the impulses are the same, but there's this power that has never existed in human history, which is to say, they can know marketers and other people can know when you got on a subway, the magazines you buy, your estimated income, the names of your children, the kind of cars you have. The list of the things that they can know goes on and on, but it goes way beyond that. These marketing companies are applying what's called analytics, artificial intelligence. There's different names for it, that can derive meaning from the patterns of details about your lives so that they're profiling. There's a phrase called psychographic modeling that's probably already out of date, but it's one guy put it very well. They're trying to get into your heads. And in fact, in a way that would blow most people's minds, they are getting inside our heads, and yet we're at the beginning of this revolution. Again, to kind of gently correct this notion that this is kind of different. In fact, we're hurtling toward a surveillance society where corporations, because we rely so much on electronic transactions, and then by extension, getting to the idea that you brought up, the government, are able to watch us like never before, which offers tremendous benefits, which we can go on and on about. But it also holds out the, I think, very unsettling promise of that we're going to be living in a watched society with few controls and very little way to know who's watching us and how they're using that information.
Well, let me ask you this. I think that that you and other writers have tried to point out to people that what the trade-off is here, because I think that there are a lot of people who would say that either that they don't care, or that they think that they're getting something, and it may be more convenience, it may be gadgets that they think do something for them in their lives, and they don't seem to, either they're not aware of what the trade-off is in loss of security and privacy, or they don't care. And it seems that what you and I think other writers have tried to say to people, at least you should know, and probably you should care.
Well, I'll point out a couple of things. There is an argument that you hear from marketers in particular that people don't care about this stuff. And yet, for the past several years, as I became more familiar with this stuff, and when I dug, I had the opportunity through the Post to essentially do a rolling investigation for several years. We know that people care, because every time I explained clearly what lay behind what seemed to be simply a convenience, there was an explosion. Laws have been changed. Companies were shut down. And before those stories appeared, it was simply, oh, this is convenient. Oh, they're going to offer you drug educational material based on, you know, your prescription records, you're getting this wonderful stuff, or you're getting this great convenience, or a company's going to buy your image and your driver's records, and they're going to be an anti-fraud company. Over and over and over again, when you looked behind the screen, you found that there was a lot more going on, and that not only was it an issue about privacy, of course that's one of the things, and data security and so on, but in fact what I'm trying to argue in No Place to Hide, and in forums like this, is that it's really not about privacy, which has become kind of a tofu word. It's really about autonomy, which is to say, the people who have the data have a great deal more power to look into your life and shape your life than they did before. without you knowing about it and without you being able to, and in a sense, taking some of your autonomy away. This is about power. This is about autonomy. And I'll add one other thing. You've mentioned me and other writers. There are clearly a lot of people who touch on these subjects, but at the risk of seeming immodest, and in fact this is immodest, but it's true, there are very few people in the United States, or for that matter in the world, that have taken the time to actually dig down into the roots of this stuff. And I feel like I've done a better job than in doing that because of the support I've had from the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Washington Post. And I still feel like I'm only getting at the beginning of it. So there are no books that have dug as deeply as No Place to Hide, and No Place to Hide falls way short of the reality.
Well, let me, I have some callers. We'll get right to them, and let me introduce again our guest, Robert O'Hara Jr. He's a reporter at the Washington Post. He is also an associate of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he is the author of the book, No Place to Hide, and it is published by Free Press. It is out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Questions are also certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have, I was going to go to callers, but if you wanted to.
Well, I was going to say, while we're waiting, the thing that makes this such a fabulous and interesting sort of story with big capitals STORY is not only the characters, people like John Poindexter, who people might recall was one of the culprits in Iran-Contra, and he reemerged as one of the geniuses in the data revolution, and Viet Dinh, a Vietnamese immigrant who went on to become the author of the Patriot Act and the Justice Department. The list of these characters goes on and on, but it's this idea that there is no easy solution. You can't turn this stuff off because we love the conveniences. You mentioned that people perceive that. Well, they're not just perceiving it. We do get tremendous benefits from the data revolution, and so the solutions that the nation has to grapple with and grapple hopefully soon with are not going to come easy. And if we don't grapple with them, they're going to become harder and harder.
Let's talk with some people who are listening. First to caller is in Indiana, and we'll go there. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. I have actually difficulty in probably asking a good question because the data stream, so to speak, is so pervasive now, it would take an extremely competent group of people with probably illegal means to cipher everything out. And I guess my question deals around with the legality of it. Why in the hell does the company have legal permission to know everything about me and all that? Why?
Well,
what happened to personal, sort of privacy, I guess, in the long run?
That's a great question.
And as a footnote, I've just discovered that we have competitors. They're over in Bulgaria and Burlese and stuff. People are already selling the card information that was taken from these last two break-ins of, the 40 million people who own MasterCard and stuff. It's not only regular governments doing it, it's, other entities that are doing it. And I think we've lost the game, but I'm just sort of interested in the legal history of why they were allowed to do all this. Somehow have the view of the invisible hand coming back in a very strange way, doing harm to people's, in a sense.
Well, we lost the caller there at the end, but I think we got the basic question.
Terrific set of questions, and I'll try to pick them off in no particular order. There is no... We use this phrase, right to privacy, but there is no right to privacy, per se. There are some interpreted rights in the Constitution, and where the government can't come barging into your homes except under the most extreme circumstances without a court order and so on. But the idea that data is private is something that we've all confected in our heads. The laws that protect us as individuals, consumers, which is a phrase I don't like to use too often, but are a hodgepodge. As I show in No Place to Hide, they have been watered down and weakened or held off by very, very good and persistent lobbying by the data industry, so that at the very time that their power to collect information was growing in the 1990s, they were appearing on Congress saying, don't get in the way of a good thing. You would deprive individuals of their their all the benefits and conveniences, which of course is a very legitimate argument, but it also opened the way for this revolution. And I should add, since he raised the issue of identity theft, it also opened the way for these companies to go like gangbusters in collecting data, and I guarantee you there's not one in 50 or 100 that's kept pace with their security procedures and technology. And guess what happens as a consequence? We have breach after breach after breach, and we have an epidemic of identity theft.
All right, let's go to, we have another caller here on line number two, and this will be a caller in Eureka, line two, right here. Hello.
Hi, could I ask two questions?
Sure.
David?
Sure.
You, in the last sentence, you sort of touched both areas. I'd like to ask about, first of all, what, in your opinion, in the breaches, I guess both Visa and MasterCard were hacked into their database, what threats would those represent to the everyday ordinary consumer in terms of the unauthorized use of their credit card? Not any other problems that could stem from that?
Okay, so here's the problem that is still not well addressed. Again, I speak very authoritatively, more so than I think I normally do, because I've been so immersed in this stuff. So forgive me if this sounds overly authoritative, but I know it to be true. So
you know more than I do.
Here's the deal: data collection and data use has exploded. It is, in fact, a revolutionary time, just as with the Internet. The Internet is a miracle of communications. Networking in general, the ability to collect and share information and make sense of it, it's all amazing stuff. I'm thrilled to be living through this time. There's lots of ugly stuff about that, however, that a lot of people, particularly the marketing corporations, that they don't want us to think about. And one of them is this. They have not kept pace with security, and that's not just in the strongholds, supposedly, of where the data is being held, the data warehouses and so on. It's how the data is used. Go to a local retailer, and I'm not going to name names, but you can read them in the book. Go to any local retailer and use your credit card and count how often the clerk even looks at your signature. There are no procedures to ensure that you are who you claim to be. That's one of the largest, most pedestrian, and powerful security gaps that we face, and it's pervasive. And without that gap at the retailer, at the bank, at the hospital, where they don't bother to really take the time and hence maybe the cost to authenticate who's using that credit card and who's claiming to be somebody for a service, with that gap open, and it's wide open everywhere you go, you will never stop identity theft. Mm-hmm. And to close the gap is going to take some hard decisions that will cost money, and the companies are not willing to do that. And until we as a society bring pressure to bear on our lawmakers, local, state, and federal lawmakers, to recognize that as a core problem, nothing will change here. You'll continue to have breaches. People will continue to take on your identity and so on. Now, one other idea that merges your question and the previous caller's question. There was this sort of open-ended thing, question about how could this happen, and I'll tell you, it happened in part because there are so few people out there still who are willing to just stand up and just sort of say this is not all sweetness and light, that in fact there are some very difficult problems that we have to address, and it's going to cost somebody some money to address them. It's going to be a little bit less efficient, and that's it's like pollution. Remember back in, I'm from Indiana, and I grew up, you know, like everybody else, hearing about, you know, pollution in Gary, Indiana, and pollution in Pittsburgh and all that sort of stuff. There was a time when people thought this is insoluble. If we try to crack down on pollution, there'll be no way to have industry. Industry will have to shut down. Well, we figured out that you could find a good balance. Yes, some companies were affected, but guess what? We can breathe better now. The air is cleaner, relatively speaking, to when it was 50 years ago. We have to come to those same conclusions about the use of data and identity theft and all the related issues.
Mm-hmm. If you call your credit card company, do they have to tell you whether your name is specifically one of the ones that's been leaked?
In California, they do. In the rest of the country, for the most part, they don't.
And they keep saying, just check your statement, check your statement.
That's there's a whole...
That's about the only, I guess that's about the only thing you really can do.
There's a whole school of thought that says it's all up to you, the individual, which is bunk in the extreme as far as I'm concerned, because, in effect, their profits, which I'm a believer in profits, I really am, but their profits are riding on your shoulders. You're doing the heavy lifting of watching out for yourself when it seems to me that if you're being put at risk without your knowledge, somebody else ought to be held responsible. And to me, it's the company that doesn't do the good job of authenticating or who's responsible for the security breaches.
I agree with you, but I think given the practicality and their lobbying power, the best thing one can do right now is be very careful in looking over your statement, right?
There's one thing that I've been preaching for a long time, and it holds true whether you're a meat-eating Republican, a lefty tree-hugger, a centrist, whatever your political values are, which is you got to have good information habits. You've got to use your credit card when you need to and to the best benefit, but not all the time.
Uh-huh.
You need to keep track of what you spend. You have to tear up your receipts. You have to track all this stuff. And unfortunately, if you get tagged, you have to jump on it immediately.
Second of all, what specific advice would you give? And I know there's a lot of generic advice about identity theft, but would you have any opinion about, and I suppose what you just said would apply, but any other thoughts about in the whole area of prevention of identity theft?
Well, when I started this book process, people said, answer the question that you want to answer, not the question that was asked. And so I'll pull that trick on you. Good information habits is something you've got to do. But the broader question is, I would urge you not to think of identity theft as the problem. Identity theft is a symptom of a much vaster problem and challenge, I should say, that we face, which is the collection of this information, the use of it, the lack of transparency in how it's being used by the corporation, the lack of oversight by the government, particularly as it pertains to the government sort of glomming onto this stuff for national security and counterintelligence and counterterrorism kind of efforts.
Okay, but you wouldn't have any more specific recommendations than what are generally given as far as what one does in terms of... good information habits. That's
good information habits. There are places you can get free credit reports now in almost every state. I would get that.
Uh-huh.
You might get it twice a year. You can just monitor things. I'm proud to say that I'm one of the least paranoid people in this newsroom and in Washington, for that matter. And I'm not very conspiracy-minded, but I am very practical, and the kind of questions you're asking are good, practical things to do.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. We're at our midpoint here. We'll continue our conversation with Robert O'Hara. He's a reporter at the Washington Post. He's written many stories on privacy and technology. He is an associate of the Center for Investigative Reporting. If you'd like to find out about what that is all about, they have a website, which is www.muckraker.org. Robert O'Hara is author of the recently published book, No Place to Hide, and it is published by the Free Press. And if you'd like to read the book, it is certainly out there in the bookstores, and also there is a website for that book, which is noplacetohide.net. And so if you're on the internet, you can look at that. Otherwise, you can go down to the bookstore and look at the book. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that a lot of people see this the shrinking of privacy story as being a kind of a post-September 11 story. But I guess I find myself wondering whether we still wouldn't be having the same conversation if September 11th hadn't happened, at least substantially the same conversation, because there are so many private interests that are collecting data, information about us, and that generally speaking, the Congress seems to be pretty much laissez-faire and let the market rip and doesn't seem to be inclined to regulate unless somebody leans on them really heavy. How much of this do you think, I mean, would we be having the same conversation or substantially the same conversation if September 11th hadn't happened?
Well, we were having that conversation before September 11th, and you're exactly right that it would be continuing. And the reason is that the amount of information that's being collected is accelerating. I'll give you one example. There's a company in Little Rock, Arkansas, Conway, Arkansas, called Axiom, A-C-X-I-O-M. In 1983, they went public as a company, and they had an extraordinary amount of data at that time for marketing and for political activity. It was 18.6 gigabytes, if I remember correctly. The amount of data that they manage now has grown by a million times, and it's accelerating. So you're exactly right. The questions would be here, but something very, very important happened after 9/11. The government turned to the private companies for data to track down the terrorist, and the doors were sort of flung open by the private companies. And initially, there was this sort of patriotic impulse that very quickly turned to almost a quest for, you know, for sort of structuring this patriotic impulse into a profit motive. And now you've got this marriage between not only the data aggregators like Axiom and ChoicePoint and LexisNexis, who are helping on counterterrorism and intelligence efforts, but between the government and hotels and the government and rental car companies and the government and you know, even bookstores in some cases. The government claims it's not going to libraries. I've heard to the contrary. In any case, they're reaching out for this data like never before, and that in many ways accelerated the debate. Now, one thing that you said is very clear. If the Patriot Act were to disappear tomorrow, the Patriot Act, of course, gave law enforcement and intelligence authorities much broader power to collect information. If that were to disappear tomorrow, we would be facing the same kinds of issues because of the private sector initiatives.
Is there someone in Congress who is leading the charge for rights of individuals to try to curb collection of data and information?
Well, no. There are people that have, they're jumping on parts of it. One of the most knowledgeable is Senator Leahy from Vermont. And you've got, you know, a variety of folks who are jumping on the identity theft. Senator Feinstein, who's, you know, California, who's, you know, focused on identity theft, although some of her legislation seems almost, you know, geared towards satisfying the companies that collect data. You have Congressman Markey, who's pushing right now on some issues related to identity theft. But there's nobody that's really going to the sort of larger issues about the government embrace of all this data for national security, counterterrorism, and so on. What I think of as the surveillance society type issues. And the core question is there enough oversight of these companies? Is there enough transparency? How do we know the government's using this stuff in a correct way? And the reason we want to ask those questions is because it's a new source of power. It sounds funny to hear that phrase because it sounds almost antique or radical somehow to talk about new sources of power, but many listeners might recall that Eisenhower's speech when he left the government and he warned, do you remember the military-industrial complex speech?
Yes.
Well, he warned that he said in the councils of government we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought by the military-industrial complex. And he said the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. And he continues that we can't take any of this for granted, and only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Well, switch the words military-industrial complex and change it to security-industrial complex. And you have a very powerful analogy to what's happening today, and there is the creation of a new sort of power that our system is designed ultimately to ensure that there's checks on and that it's used properly. And that means that people have got to get up and they've got to call their congressmen and urge them to find that right balance.
Mm. There certainly are private organizations who are concerned with civil liberties, who are concerned with privacy, who are concerned about free exchange of information that have weighed in on these issues ever since September 11th.
That's right.
Are there any that you think have been particularly effective voices in this?
Well, let me list some of them, and you'll see a kind of an amazing case of strange bedfellows that's actually been around on this issue for a while. One of them is the Free Congress Foundation, which is a very ardent, very conservative group. Another one, and probably the broadest and one of the most active on this, is the American Civil Liberties Union. You have some smaller groups that are deeply knowledgeable about this as well, and they occupy slightly different places on the political continuum. One of them is called the Center for Democracy and Technology, and another one is the Electronic Privacy Information Center. There's a whole array of others, there's a constellation of different groups that that follow this. There's a fellow in Rhode Island, Robert Smith, who has an organization that's been around forever and is really, really, he really knows a lot, Privacy Journal. You have just a whole variety of groups. So there are a lot of people who are aware of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, it does. It seems interesting that on this case, and I think it's also true with the Patriot Act, that there, while one might think that this is the kind of thing that would mostly concern liberals, that there certainly are a lot of conservatives who are concerned about the power of big government and are voicing concerns about the Patriot Act. There are conservatives who have backed who have said, as the ACLU have said, that those provisions that have the sunset provision should be allowed to sunset, and you know, they're very concerned about government power. And in this particular case, there are parallel kinds of concerns, and there are conservatives that are concerned about this as just as liberals are.
In my follow-up to the Patriot Act, I spent a great deal of time with Viet Dinh, who was the primary author. And in talking with Viet Dinh about this stuff, I found myself in very unusual territory, because suddenly I'm hearing Viet Dinh sort of supporting the Patriot Act and his work on it, saying that he was ordered by John Ashcroft to think outside the box but not outside the Constitution, and he was very, very proud of the work that he did. But when it came to the data revolution and the government's embrace of that, these partnerships, public-private partnerships for intelligence and security, Viet's startling message was that, as far as he was concerned, that, and I'm going to read you a quote, "the amount of information publicly available to businesses is mind-boggling. It really belies the notion that each of us has an expectation to be left alone. So many people know about what we do." And he goes on to say, "the leap in technology has not been met with the proportionate response in terms of how we think of this technology." In other words, he's saying this is way beyond the laws and regulations of the United States of America. This is the author of the Patriot Act saying that.
Hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the expansion in devices, stuff that we might all have in our homes, might all actually even carry on our persons, that are, in a sense, data collection devices.
Sure.
And tell us various, tell someone various things about us, including where we are at any given point.
Sure. One thing that I remember years ago, I was in a grocery store and doing a story about the shopper cards that allowed us to get discounts. Now, these are very, very clever marketing devices, because you're being told that if you have one of these cards, you're going to get a discount. Well, nobody's ever quite figured out how to measure this, but it seems clear that the overall prices are going to be raised higher, and then they're lowered if you have the card, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing the story about these cards and how they work, and, you know, I'm interviewing people in line, and there's one woman who said, "Yeah, what do I care? They know what I buy. It's just dog food and soap and so on." And that's a very typical response that people have, and it's related to the notion, if I've done nothing wrong, what do I care? The thing that people need to realize And the thing that these companies certainly realize is that it's not any one thing that you do or buy. It's the aggregation that creates a portrait of who you are and what you're likely to do. It's the totality of it. So when you drive through a toll booth, that may mean nothing. It does mean nothing. It's just you going through at a particular time and place with your fast pass, an RFID, radio frequency identification, and it automatically pays, and you get your convenience, and life is good. What people don't realize, of course, is that establishes that you were in a certain place at a certain time, and you left the road at a certain time in a certain place. And there's another card that you have to get into your office, and that establishes a certain time and place, and it also establishes the time between the moment that you left the highway and got to the office. This is the kind of thing that investigators like to know about. The same thing occurs when you use your shopper card. Yes, it records what you buy, but it also establishes your presence there at a certain time and place. And by the way, the fact that you buy Twinkies and cheap beer and lots of cheap beer over time and alcoholic mixes, you know, for your Tom Collins or whatever you're drinking, as well as the steaks, as well as the cigarettes, all of that's recorded. Well, if an insurance company ever got a hold of that and wanted to start taking stock of which customers, you know, it wanted to slowly sort of edge out of their insurance because they were high risk, it's going to happen. How do we know it's going to happen? Well, the DEA investigators have found that those shopper card lists that are collected electronically and which, by the way, are available to them with a subpoena or a court order, which is not hard to get, can tell a lot about whether someone ought to be investigated more deeply, a suspect, because of the things they buy. Maybe they're buying certain products that help cut drugs or to move bags of marijuana or something. It's been done. I know it. I talked to the investigators. Your cell phone more and more establishes your place. Right now it might be a mile or a couple miles, but more and more as we get what's called the electronic 911 that was mandated by Congress, It's going to establish a much more precise location. And by the way, the marketers are already starting to take advantage of that. If you get on the marketing list, to call you as you're going by a fast food restaurant, for example. Hey, stop on in. We're right down the road on the left. Stop on in. We're, you know, having a special for people who are our cell phone customers. When you use a credit card, if you live in a place like Washington or New York, to get your pass, your electronic card to swipe when you ride the metro system, well, your identity is linked to that card, and every trip you take is recorded on that card. Again, you have nothing to fear because you've done nothing wrong, but if there's a mistake or if they want to do an investigation or if they want to market to you differently, you know, the jig is up. It's going to happen. These are the kinds of things. If you have OnStar in your car, which is a system, not just OnStar, but any of the kinds of car system where you can call emergency aid, when you can get maps electronically, you can know exactly where you are on the planet. Well, if you can know it, it's being recorded because it's an electronic transaction and somebody else could know it as well. The point is that more and more of our lives are being electronically recorded, and more companies are finding ways to try to drive profit by really getting to know you. It's changing the whole notion of getting to know you.
Here, I guess, and also here now with the example that you gave, you point out the problem that we might have some technology that we might argue on the one hand has a positive benefit, like having the cell phone be able to tell the police where you are if there's an emergency.
Every technology, by the way, has positive benefits.
Absolutely. So I guess then the issue is we've been talking about this all the way through, but how do we get some balancing of the good and the bad, or how do we at least address the downside?
It's a funny thing. I held my punch on policy recommendations, and I think it was a good decision. I've been criticized for it by some folks, but I held my punch because it's so hard, and it's so complex that it's really going to take an energized citizenry, left, right, and center, to engage on this thing. And yet the interesting thing here that I've concluded is that it's almost going to take, in a sense, some radical steps. And I think any change comes from radical steps of people finally saying, particularly the centrists, the moms and dads of the world, right, who say, wait a second, enough is enough. This is out of control. I have lost too much control over something that feels too intimate, even if I don't know how all the downsides of it, even if I don't have anything to hide, there is something inherently private about knowing what sex magazines I think I should read as an adult, or where I go on vacation, or how, you know, there, it's hard to define, but we all know that there's something that's legitimate and positive about having a quiet, private space, an area where people don't have necessarily a right to know, and yet these companies have made it their mission to know this stuff, and in many cases, resell it.
We're moving into our last 10 minutes or so. I have a caller we'll get right to. I want to introduce again the guest, Robert O'Hara. He's a reporter at the Washington Post. He's also associate of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for articles that he wrote on privacy and technology, and also recipient of the 2003 Carnegie Mellon Cybersecurity Reporting Award. His book is No Place to Hide. It's been out now for a couple of months. It's published by the Free Press. If you want to read the book, you go out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here listening in Aurora, up not too far from Chicago, on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, I went into one of the larger grocery stores, and I couldn't find my preferred card. I asked them if they'd get me another one. So he said, yes, what is your Social Security number? And I said, I will not give you my Social Security number. That's against the law for you to ask for it. And he just looked at me, didn't say anything, and I said, I walked away. I just can't believe that a large company like that doesn't know that that's against the law.
The Social Security number has, contrary to the original intentions, become an all-purpose national identification.
Yes.
And that's part of the identity theft problem. If you call your bank and you say, I'd like my balance, they'll say, well, what are the last four digits of your Social Security number? The irony there is that despite all the problems that yours truly and others have documented with identity theft and the free availability, you can still get a Social Security number. I could get your Social Security number if I were nefarious and inclined, probably in 3 or 4 hours tops, and I could do it for $25 or less.
And, you know, then I went to the neighborhood college, and I was going to work as a tutor. So I gave them the information, and they wanted my age and my Social Security number. And I said, I won't give you either. I don't want to give it to you. So I left. But, you know, they called me anyway.
Well, you know,
I just don't think people know those things, that there is some part of us that we want to remain part of us.
It's funny, holding the ground like that with some sort of backbone like you have, seems very, very radical to people. How many times have you been in line when a clerk will ask the person in front of you, what's your home phone number? And people will give it away. They give it away even if it's unlisted, and they don't even know why they're giving it. And here's the answer why. The people asking for it are basically, without telling the customer, they're saying, give me your home phone number so that I can build a dossier, because once you give me that phone number, you're giving me permission to know a lot more about you by going to a commercial data provider. And they will also turn around and resell that home telephone number, because in some cases it's an unlisted number that's very valuable to marketers.
Can I ask you another question?
Okay.
When are you going to do something about junk mail?
Well, I'm just a storyteller and an investigator.
I wish you would do something about junk mail.
Okay.
I haven't been able to. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions are welcome. We have maybe about 5 minutes. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things that I think concerns people most is the idea that, yes, we do have all of these various places that are collecting different sorts of bits of information. Most of these are private companies that for various reasons, marketing, security, credit assessment, trying to sell us stuff, they're putting together information about us. One of the big concerns I think people had is that there would be one central place and that it would be in the government someplace, that everything that all of the various collectors were collecting would all be accessible with the stroke of one key. That was sort of the idea behind this total information awareness idea that was promoted by John Poindexter. You talked about him a little bit earlier. That did not happen, but the worry still is, I think, that such a thing would be put into place.
Well, first of all, that wasn't the idea of total information awareness. It was much more complex and much richer. And interestingly enough, there was never really an honest debate about that program, ominous as it was, because a lot of the backlash had to do with the previous wars over Iran-Contra. It was shut down in large part as quickly as it was because of it was political payback. It was part of the Washington games that are played, and they're ruthless games, which isn't to say there weren't profound questions raised by total information awareness, but it wasn't what you described. It was much more complex and so on. But here's an interesting thing about one centralized data system. You're going to hear going forward marketers and data specialists say, no, don't have. We agree. No one data system. That will solve the privacy question. But the irony is, computing has become so good and networking has become so good that you could have 100 computers and still make a single query and still get an answer back in a flash. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that we do or don't have a one single database has become a canard. More and more people are going to start hearing about something that has been mandated by law, it's underway, and almost no journalists are writing about it, which is the creation of a national intelligence information sharing system that will link law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies across the United States. It's going to be the backbone of a domestic intelligence system. It's underway. It was mandated by the intelligence reform legislation last winter. It's underway. It's going to enable unprecedented amounts of sharing of both criminal, investigative, and commercial information. And yet there's almost no public debate about it.
So the reason, just to go back, the reason that total information awareness didn't go forward was because of the baggage that Poindexter brought along with him?
I think largely. Mm-hmm. There certainly was no honest debate about what total information awareness was. I mean, it proposed a sort of a global surveillance system, but it wasn't just having all the data in one place. It was actually going to use distributed networking and so on. I mean, like I said, don't get me wrong, it was a big deal and so on, but one of the downsides of you know, the political battle over Poindexter's presence and over, you know, of course, some of the specifics of total information awareness is it was just pushed underground because a lot of total information awareness programs continue.
Hmm. Well, we're just about the point where we have to finish. I guess I'd give the opportunity to say, what sort of idea would you like to leave people with?
That this is not a time to be passive and to let people be. I hate to say this because I'm so anti-conspiracy-minded and anti-paranoid and so on, but don't just stand by and let the marketers and the data companies and the credit bureaus and so on give you the message of what's happening, because they are not going to give you the complete message. It just isn't going to happen.
Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish up. Again, our guest this morning, Robert O'Hara. He is a reporter at the Washington Post. He's also an associate of the Center for Investigative Reporting. If you're interested in finding out what that center is about, you can go to their website, which is www.muckraker.org. Otherwise, there is a website for the book, which is noplacetohide.net. And you can go there and learn more about it. And if you want to look at the book, it's certainly available in bookstores. It's titled, again, No Place to Hide. It's published by the Free Press. And thanks very much for talking with us today.